Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Stephen Dozman. In recent years, questions around the nature of truth in facts have re-entered public debate, often in discussions around journalistic bias and whether politically neutral reporting is possible or even desirable. Many pundits have tried to place blame for the increasingly slippery and fickle nature of truth in reporting on the ideas developed in much 20th century philosophy, particularly postmodern theory. However, my guest today, Santiago Zabala, argues that this is to mistake a diagnosis for the condition itself, and makes the case in his recent book, Being at Large, Freedom in the Age of Alternative Facts, that much of the hermeneutic and postmodern philosophical traditions can help us navigate these times out of joint. Santiago Zabala is a philosopher and cultural critic and ICREA research professor of philosophy at the Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona. He is author of many books, including, among others, Why Only Art Can Save Us, Aesthetics in the Absence of Emergency from Columbia University Press in 2017. His opinion articles have appeared in The Guardian, The New York Times, and Al Jazeera, among other international media outlets. So, Santiago Zabala, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we always like to have authors introduce themselves. So can you tell us a bit about who you are and what your main research tends to focus on?
Yeah, sure. My philosophical investigations are, of course, very much affine with continental philosophy and in particular with hermeneutics. My research, at least these past years, have dealt mostly with political philosophy and how to understand political philosophy through hermeneutics. This brand new book, it's really a way to sum up many of the themes that I tried to develop this past years, in particular the problem of being, of ontology, the problem of interpretation, hermeneutics, and also, of course, the problem of emergency. All these three concepts I tried to understand through what today we call the age of alternative facts. All this, of course, take into consideration that Heidegger is more or less the starting point for all philosophical investigations. Although my reading of Heidegger, of course, it's very different from the ones that many other people do, as all classics have different interpreters. Mine has a lot to do with the reading of Heidegger that an Italian philosopher did, Gianni Vattimo, and also in part also with what Richard Rorty did with Heidegger.
Wonderful. So in the beginning of your book, you look at the now famous bit about alternative facts from Kellyanne Conway. You argue that the reason alternative facts hit such a strange cultural nerve is because it came at a time when various other questions related to institutions, authority, and truth were being raised. So as an introduction to your book, can you unpack how you understand the nature of truth in our current cultural moment?
Right. This is an excellent question, particularly the idea of cultural nerve. I think that sort of sums up the problem today. The problem with truth today, I think it has a lot to do with with this so-called return to order that I like to discuss. We have since 9/11, and I think also since this emergency we're now confronting, this pandemic, there has been a big return to order. In other words, an intensification of the framing powers that in some way limit our freedoms. So when people discuss or say that after 9/11 everything changed, I think it's quite the opposite. There has been an intensification of the structures of power that were already at work before. In other words, after 9/11, we had more military intervention in the Middle East. We had more financial constraints throughout. And of course, even from a technological point of view and civilians, things got even worse. And this is, it seems that this is also what's going to happen now with this emergency we're facing now. So the problem with truce now is that in some way, all this intensifications have in some way requested us or requested some of us to in some way to defend ourselves even more. And of course, I'm referring to defense in the sense of returning to those closed societies that Popper already criticized almost a century ago. So the idea is that truce today has been framed even more. In other words, this return to order that in some way Conway, it's only a symptom, because her idea of requesting of trying to tell us that there are alternative truths. In this case, she was referring to the statement about the attendance numbers at Trump inauguration in 2017. She's really imposing a truth. So in some way, truth has been the idea that we can in some way discuss what truth is has been dissolved, has been lost once again. And this is because truth is being imposed now. Much more than before. So this imposition in some ways what has been framing this cultural return to order, which I claim it's very clear and it's very it can be felt very well in a number of intellectuals, not only in speculative realism or new realism as they call it, but also in some continental philosophy that has a lot to do with phenomenology. So the idea is that truth, in some way, has been framed once again, and it's been imposed in such a way that everybody has its own truth, but in such a way that it's framed. There is no possibility of interpretation anymore. So if there is no possibility of interpretation anymore, everybody imposes its own. Of course, creating a higher conflict, and this conflict, I think it's evident in the way Trump, of course, tweets the press, but not only Trump, of course. This return to order that I mentioned, it's also obvious in many right-wing populists that we'll discuss later.
Wonderful kind of introduction then. So turning to Martin Heidegger's philosophy, which forms the conceptual backbone of much of your work, you turn to his understanding of metaphysics, which he understands as the history of different formations of being. And one of the most dominant elements of this history for him was metaphysics as parousia or presence. Can you explain what he meant by this?
Okay, so, on the one hand, Heidegger, his idea of metaphysics and the way his destruction of metaphysics he operates in Being and Time, it's all about trying to explain how being has only been interpreted as something present, and has something present right now, in other words, in the present. This is a problem because in some way existence has been determined by time, not only exclusively in presence, but also ignoring other times, in other words, other presences there can be. And this is what he called in Being and Time in paragraph 44, if I remember correctly, the ontological difference. Now, for those of us who are not philosophers, this basically what Heidegger is trying to tell us is that, philosophy and, of course, all the other disciplines as well have been in some way conditioned by this interpretation of being, of reality. Of course, this is, from a philosophical point of view, this is the reading I try to make of Heidegger. It's something very poor. In other words, being, your reality, it's not simply what is here present. There's much more at stake. If we now think of the mouse we have here in our hand, perhaps, well, the mouse, it's an object. We call it a mouse. It's useful for a certain, to navigate on internet, for example. But that's not all, right? It's so many other things which its meanings are implied in the difference of its object. In other words, this mouse also has, it can be something useful, it can be something beautiful, it can be something, its objectivity is not its only meaning in some way. And the idea of Heidegger is that, well, we have to be very careful and we have to understand, okay, we have to in some way dismantle or deconstruct, as Derrida and so many others would do afterwards, this idea that, well, that objects are, they're just there, and we don't really have to do anything else besides trying to describe them as accurately as we can. This is why it is very important to understand Heidegger's notion or idea of metaphysics as some sort of limitation we have. And this limitation has also a lot to do with an indifference we have towards what objects might mean or what object can in some way tell us. And this, of course, is something that, you know, we feel now, I hope some of us understand, for example, with climate change. In other words, we are framed within one understanding of how we can use the climate, with the environment, when of course there are many others. But how come we don't move toward this, we don't overcome that? Well, we don't overcome that because of the way we think, and the way we think, it's purely framed within metaphysics. So this is the way I like to understand what Heidegger's problem with the ontological difference. In other words, between how we interpret what being is and whether it's important to know what being is in itself. This difference is more or less at the center of, I think, of Heidegger's philosophy, but also of how we should think not only about Heidegger's philosophy or about philosophy, but also how we should actually philosophize in some way. Philosophy does not end with the ontological difference, in other words, by understanding this framing, but actually it starts from there. So we have to move beyond this.
One of the ways Heidegger wants to shift our understanding of philosophy is to think of it as a conversation, hence his somewhat casualized entry into philosophy with the question, how's it going with being? What happens when we think of philosophy in conversational terms as opposed to a series of monologues?
Okay, so, the question you how's it going with being? It's a translation of the new fundamental question of philosophy that Heidegger poses in Introduction to Metaphysics, 1936. And it's a very important question that he, because the original or the classical fundamental question of philosophy is different, right? It's basically why is there nothing instead of something? Well, Heidegger transformed in 1936 these questions and think that, well, perhaps we should change, you know, the main question of philosophy by how we state this with them saying, how is it going with being? And this is, I think, it's revolutionary. And actually, I work on this on another book of mine, The Remains of Being, because if we agree that the fundamental question of philosophy should deal with the condition of being, in other words, that we agree that being or reality, we should in some way try to understand reality through being, through this vital concept that basically distinguished philosophy from all the other sciences. Why is this important? Well, it's important because it allows us to have a conversation with being rather than a dialogue. This difference between conversation and dialogue is it's vital to understand in particular what Heidegger would do later on. In other words, in the second Heidegger we have after the 1930s. It's vital because it allows philosophy not to be framed within not simply one understanding of being, but also to understand that that being is really a possibility we have to continue to philosophize. In other words, if being would be one objective or one description in itself, or one description that we can sort of be all satisfied within, well, philosophy would be over. There wouldn't be any more questions. And instead, what Heidegger is trying to tell us here is that, well, if we understand being as something that we have to relate ourselves to being, and that being also has to relate to us, in other words, it speaks to us in some way, events in history in some way, they continue to speak to us, well, then philosophy becomes a conversation that allows all those differences that I mentioned before to emerge. So this is something also that Gadamer picked up from, Gadamer was one of Heidegger's most important, probably the most important disciple, and he insisted very much on the difference between a conversation and a dialogue, because in a dialogue, we all know where it's going to end. A conversation is more loose. In a way, it's at large, like I like to call being now. We don't know how it's going to end. Plato, for example, he had dialogue, right? He explained to the slave what was outside the cave, and if he did not understand it, he would drag him out with violence, right, to show him the truth. Well, that's more or less what happened in Iraq, trying to force everybody to vote for democracy. Instead, the idea of conversation is different. There's a sort of an exchange there that if we are open enough to accept it or to understand differently in some way, then we might get both to somewhere else and also change all of us together. So the idea of a conversation is to allow being to continue to speak to us, and of course to allow ourselves also to change through that same conversation.
One of the most important elements of Heidegger's thought is his understanding of truth, which you show was a key point of contention between him and his philosophical mentor, Edmund Husserl. What was the conception of truth Heidegger was pushing against, and how did he want us to think of truth?
Well, Heidegger, it's important to remember that he ended his collaboration with Husserl not only because he interpreted phenomenology in a very metaphysical way, but also because he attempted to dissolve philosophy in a series of regional ontologies, which, by the way, are at the origins of much realism today. It's important to remember also that, well, Husserl thought of truth in terms of difference between mere intention and the matter itself, which also in some way presupposed that duplicity of being common to our metaphysical tradition. So in some way, there is a difference here between the manner in which something in fact appears and the manner in which it is in itself. Now, Heidegger contrasted this. He did not believe that this was this in some way was not taking the ontological difference seriously. And so Heidegger in some way he thought to turn everything around and in some way try to explain that a statement, for example, this is a mouse in my hand, is not the primary place of truth, but it's the other way around. In other words, the statement it's only a mode of appropriation of how the mouse discloses itself. In other words, for Heidegger, truth is not something that we can in some way, even in some way, assimilate to an aesthetic vision. On the contrary, for Heidegger, truth is a disclosedness. It's in a way it's a form of lighting. This is, I think it's a good way to explain this. It's a form of allowing objects to reveal themselves on its own. In order to do this, of course, one has to be open for this. in order for truth not to be simply a correspondence between what we think of it and what the object is in itself, we have to be open to the other possibilities, in other words, to what the former metaphysical conceptual scheme, which is the one of Husserl and of all metaphysics, does not allow us to see. In other words, there's something missing there. Heidegger thinks that whatever is missing is in a way more important. And so the idea of interpreting truth as a disclosedness, as what opens up, it's also a way of not only of overcoming metaphysics, but also of overcoming the indifference of metaphysics. Heidegger talks about metaphysics as being a very indifferent conceptual scheme, because it does not take everything, it does not take those things that do not emerge immediately. So the idea of Heidegger is that, well, truth is not simply what is objective in front of you. It is actually even before that, it is what discloses itself. This, of course, has a lot to do with how we understand language. And even before that, how language discloses itself throughout the different epochs of being.
Turning to interpretation, you start bringing in a number of other thinkers to supplement your understanding of hermeneutics here. A couple key thinkers you bring into play are Gianni Vattimo and Richard Rorty, who emphasized hermeneutics' role as a form of or tool for political resistance. How did they see hermeneutics playing this role in our contemporary philosophical and political landscape?
So, yeah, this is important because both Rorty and Vattimo, in a way, are closer to Heidegger's hermeneutics than Gadamer. This is something very important because a lot of people, unfortunately, the history of hermeneutics has been very much conditioned by Gadamer, who, by the way, was the big architect of the of what we understand of hermeneutics today. But at the same time, Gadamer, of course, similar to Heidegger, was also very conservative, and the problem is that he presented in Truth and Methods in 1960, he presented a history and an understanding of hermeneutics that's a quite conservative key. The truth is that Gadamer had to, in some way, prepare hermeneutics for academia. In other words, create a discipline out of hermeneutics. And so this is why the role of dialogue, the way he proposed dialogue, was also a little bit conservative. Here, what's important about Rorty and Vattimo is that in some way they are closer to what Heidegger's sort of hermeneutic. For Heidegger, hermeneutic was a very practical matter. It was something that had to do with an activity, actually. And that's why it had, for Heidegger, the origins of hermeneutics in Hermes, in the Greek god, of being in some way an anarchic figure, it's vital for them. This is why in the second part, I try to open up a whole history of hermeneutics by not only talking about Rorty and Vattimo, but also Freud, Nietzsche, Augustine, and Luther, because there is an anarchic vein that runs throughout hermeneutics. So its interpretation is not a pacific enterprise about dialogue. Interpretation is an anarchic activity, which is in part also quite dangerous. There is always a moment of danger in interpretation. Why? Well, Rorty and Vattimo have not only in some way explained it, but also have to put this in practice. In other words, if we think about who interprets, who are the ones who need to interpret? Well, certainly not the ones that are satisfied with the order, with whatever the order is today. The ones to interpret are the ones that are not happy at all with the order, with the way reality is. These are the ones who practice hermeneutics. So when Luther, for example, translated the Bible and translated for the first time the Bible, he was literally saying, well, everybody should be able to interpret the Bible. It's not something that should be only for a certain number of people. So the idea here is that, well, Vattimo and Rorty, they both use hermeneutics to go, the first one to go against the political consequences of globalization, and Rorty said to go against the rigidity of analytic philosophy. this is Batimo, of course, he went all the way for him, globalization represented a more advanced and established phase of Adorno and Horkheimer, the total administrative organization system, which of course today has reached levels which Adorno would have not have imagined. And for Batimo, the idea is that hermeneutics allowed in some way to disrupt, to break, and to create some sort of problem within this system. Hermeneutics is a problem as a discipline. It is constantly trying to suggest not only different interpretation, but also to stress that interpretation is itself what existence is. And this is why for Batimo, interpretation in some way, it is the method we have basically to unmask in some way the complicity of power, and also in particular the role that now philosophy is starting to have for a while now been in some way submitting to science. So hermeneutics is a problem for institutions, for the establishment, and actually basically for all society to a certain point, because it's really a request of freedom to maintain the possibility of freedom open. So while for Batimo, hermeneutics is very useful to unmask this political problem we have today, for Roth instead it was more an issue of trying to show how analytic philosophy back in the 50s, in the 60s, and in the 70s, and I actually think also today to some extent, has been too linguistic, but also too logical in some way. For Rorty, hermeneutics was also a problem because by endorsing hermeneutics, he at the same time he also lost his job when he published A Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature in 1979. Rorty was basically forced afterwards to move to a comparative literature department. His idea that hermeneutics was the future of philosophy and that analytic philosophy had to run its course was a sort of a terrorist attack a terrorist intellectual attack at the time in American academia. So for both of them, hermeneutics it's a way to demonstrate that philosophy has to maintain a conflictual stance in some way. The hermeneutical stance for Rorty and Batimo is a request to maintain freedom open, and therefore any political or philosophical system that tries to frame it would be necessary to in some way unmask. And I think this is what hermeneutic meant for them.
After this history of hermeneutics, you turn to the idea of emergency, which was developed in Heidegger's concept of Notlosigkeit, which is a fairly difficult to translate term, but also a very important one, especially in his post-being and time work. So can you give us a sense of what he meant by it and what you're trying to get at with it?
Well, yes. Well, the idea of Nert, which is translated the idea of distress, flight, or emergency, it's a concept that became central for Heidegger in the 1930s, which has a lot to do with the idea of the technological replacement of beings with beings. In other words, with the idea that in some way calculation and technology has reached a level of framing, of control, to such a point that, even emergencies have become framed in some way. The idea is that for Heidegger, which Heidegger did not really discuss too much, this problem of emergency. This can be found in, Richard Paul has a very good book on the problem of Heidegger and emergency. I try to move beyond that. But the idea of Heidegger is that, the greatest emergency is the absence of emergency. And what he means by this is that, the greatest emergency we have is that being cannot emerge anymore, right? Being cannot emerge from that technological system we have in some way created. Now, I think it's important to hear the problem. For Heidegger, here the problem was very much related to technology. I tried to move a little bit beyond this and try to understand that, well, now the greatest emergencies are the ones which are missing. This does not mean that certain emergencies we have are not important. But we have to be able in some way to interpret those tensions in history that allow these emergencies to come out. So when Heidegger explains that the problem is that it's not when something doesn't function, but rather when everything functions. It's a way of suppressing this idea of emergency. In other words, we have, for Heidegger, we have created such a system of control and functioning where it's been lost, and what has in some way been lost is thought. In other words, our practice of thinking. It is very difficult to think nowadays. It is much more easy to calculate in some way. So for Heidegger, Heidegger believes we have lost those tensions with that in some way animate history and also animate our ways to think. Actually, in one of the volumes of the Black Notebooks, Heidegger even mentioned how it has been unacceptable today to make mistakes. And this is actually something that is quite true. So what are we losing by creating this system of total functioning? Well, again, we're losing a certain freedom, right? A certain freedom to make mistakes. But often out of these mistakes, there's also a creation, in particular if we think in the humanities, but not only in the humanities. So this is what I think Heidegger was going for. And again, this is not, for Heidegger, this is not an ontic issue. This is an ontological issue. And the problem of emergency for Heidegger is also a problem of being not taking place anymore, not occurring anymore. So we have to find ways to allow being to emerge again. And of course, the idea of emergency has a lot to do with the word to emerge too.
Jumping off of this discussion, you turn to a number of other European thinkers such as Carl Schmitt, Walter Benjamin, and Giorgio Agamben, who all had various ideas around the concept of emergency. So obviously there are going to be variations between them, but you see a kind of core set of ideas coming up in this section, particularly relating to the personal or existential and how it connects with the political. So can you unpack what's going on here regarding the importance of emergency?
Yes. I think the best way to understand the difference also between what I understand by emergency and what these authors you mentioned do is by thinking of state of exception or state of emergency became central concepts right after 9/11 and the publication of Agamben's state of exception. Agamben believes that the state of exception has become vital to understand and interpret global politics after George Bush's invasion of Iraq. So the declaration of a state of exception, according to Agamben, has not only disclosed the performative expression of state power, but also foreclosed in some way any possibilities of meaningful democratic politics. Now, I think that a good way to understand this is to think about Trump today. I think instead that the state of exception, it's not enough today to understand politics. In other words, and Trump in some way, and also some other right-wing populists, they point this out because while for Bush, What was important was to try to exercise extra legal power to transform state of exception into routine political measures. For Trump, instead, the idea is to deny emergency altogether. In other words, the absence of emergency that I try to explain, it's perfectly evident in Trump. For Trump, there are no emergencies, or even worse, the emergencies that are there depend on what he says. So when Trump declares that our environmental crisis is not an emergency, which he declared many times, and he also, we've seen this even this past month with the coronavirus, well, that's where the greatest emergency turns out, right? And that's where the big problem is. I'm not saying that there aren't many emergencies like refugee crisis, which is a clear emergency, or the rise of right-wing populism, which is also another emergency. But the greatest emergency is when we deny them. And so the example we have now of downplaying the coronavirus, which, by the way, is something that basically only Trump and Bolsonaro have still tried to do in some way or are trying to, they are incarnating this idea of the absence of emergency. Now, what is important here is to remember that the idea here is that Heidegger's idea of the absence of emergency, in a way, it is phenomenologically comes before Agamben, Schmitt, and Benjamin's state of exception. In other words, the idea that the sovereign decides on state's exception is really a consequence of metaphysics, of this total organization and framing of reality, and et cetera, et cetera. So the idea here is that if we want to understand our spiritual or political predicament today, we need to first understand why the greatest emergency is the absence of emergency. It is through the absence of emergency that we will understand whether what the sovereign will do or will not do. This is the way I think it's the best way to move from one to the other, and to understand that the absence of emergency is really how we should understand today not only our greatest emergency, but also what being has become. In other words, what we discussed at the beginning. So being cannot even emerge anymore, cannot even emerge as an emergency anymore. So this is particularly dangerous, and I think it's something that should be thought about by all philosophers.
Developing off of the ideas here around the lack of emergency, you look at several instances of lack or resistance. One of the first ones you see is regarding populism, which you consider a sort of political emergency, albeit one with a large hostility towards it. Can you kind of unpack the dynamic you see going on here?
Okay, well, first of all, in the book, what I try to explain that I try to point out three greatest emergencies we have today. And well, one of them, of course, is this one of populism. And my idea here is to, first of all, to distinguish populism between right wing and left wing populism. I do not really. There could be a third version of populism today, which is digital populism. But in the book, I discuss, following Chantal Mouffe and Ernesto Laclau works, there is a difference between right wing and left wing populism. It's not the same. Populism is. It's a sort of doesn't really mean anything if we do not. It's like democracy. It could be both. It could be lying more to the left or to the right. There is a difference there, and I think that what the greatest emergency today is, it's not the fact that we have right wing populism, but rather that we don't have any leftist populism. This is, I think, the greatest emergency we have today. So. Also, it's important. So what is the difference between one and the other? Because unfortunately, the fact that we talk about populism in a very broad and general way without making this distinction, I think it's very unfair to those leftist populists who have not been able to secure power or voted a secure power in this recent times, except for a few countries like Spain, where I live now. So in some way, right-wing populism, it's based on the idea of fear of the foreigner, also based on hatred and indifference. And all this, of course, you can find this in right-wing populists as Trump and Bolsonaro, who basically work following this this scheme. Left-wing populism, as I said, is different. It's hope for a better future. It's based on equality and justice for all. And instead of excluding categories of people, it focuses on sectors of the establishment at the service of neoliberalism, of the neoliberal global corporation. So the idea of left-wing populism, one should question how come there aren't any leftist populists. I think that's one of the reasons, one of the greatest emergencies we have today. And the fact that we do not distinguish between one and the other, it's also another big problem we have. But the issue here is how come leftist populism have not been able to emerge in this situation? Of course, this has a lot to do with that, with the return to order and return to reality that I mentioned before.
You look at the currently developing issue of climate change as operating as a sort of emergency for us, albeit one that is often either hidden from view or depicted in the form of individual disconnected crises, disabling their capacity to function as proper emergencies. Can you explain what you see going on and how we often think about climate change here?
Yes. Climate change, of course, it's my favorite example to discuss the absence of emergency, because here we are in the midst of a pandemic that we've been warned many, many times for years, and also even last year, the WHO director warned us that we should be prepared for some such an emergency. But again, the greatest emergency is the one that are absent, the one that we do not take into consideration at all. So the idea here is that a crisis like the coronavirus we're facing now, it simply suggests that in some way this is an emergency that until very recently was absent. Now it has turned into an emergency. It has become an emergency in some way. Unfortunately, the problem here is that this is not the only emergency we have. In the book, I talk about biodiversity, which is actually probably at the origin of this this pandemic we have today. And biodiversity loss is one of the greatest emergencies we have not been confronted in this past year, and now the coronavirus is a good example of, it's a good consequences of that. The problem with, I think that we should remember here is that, climate change, it's an emergency, it's an absent emergency, and will probably continue to be an absent emergency after this pandemic, after we overcome this pandemic, and I hope it will be very soon. But I wonder whether if we haven't been able to tackle the environmental emergency, which, by the way, there are many more viruses waiting for us under glaciers, the problem with the environment is that here the ontological difference of Heidegger, I think, would work very well to understand, because the ontological difference would allow us to see those possibilities, those differences that we don't want to imagine in some way, not even take into consideration. I think the environment is very important here, because it's a philosophical issue that in some way concerns the philosopher, but it concerns also its relation to being. It's also natural in some way. That's why Heidegger talks a lot about the uprooting from the earth. We have to, in some way, return to that earth, and returning into that earth means to think about the environment. I tried to plan this, but I Anyway, let's move on.
Yeah, so finally, you turn to the example of whistleblowers as figures trying to create an emergency for us, bringing to light certain events that have been covered up, often at great risk to themselves, as in the case of figures like Julian Assange, Ed Snowden, or Chelsea Manning. Or one could also think of some of the journalists who lost their lives in the wake of the publication of the Panama Papers. So how do whistleblowers function in terms of a hermeneutic emergency here?
Okay, well, it's a very good question because the problem with whistleblowers here and it's that they have shown us that the value or even the weight of truth. They have shown us that even if we show you the truth, all the documents, we show you everything, nothing would change. So they in some way, the way they reveal truth and how truth has been revealed, it's a very good indication that, well, truth does not work, does not stand up for itself alone. Truth needs, just like, in other words, neither of these whistleblowers, and of course there are many more besides the one that I mentioned, you're right to refer to the ones of the Panama Papers too, their work only works, only functions if a big paper allows them to tell the news. In other words, they are the incarnation of the hermeneutical idea that, well, truth alone does not work. You need major newspapers, you need government agencies, you need academics, we need a huge amount of people to help us, to help facts in some way. Facts alone don't work. This is why the truth they revealed would not have emerged if it wouldn't have been for those, I think it's the Guardian, New York Times, and the other papers that allow them to publish those news. So in some way, they are telling us that they are showing us how framed we are. The fact that so few, almost, I don't think any government has been, very few government have had serious troubles after some of this revelation, it's an indication that of how framed the system is. Framed to the point of not making a very big difference if we know precisely everything, the actual truth. And so I think that in some way, hermeneutics, they are telling us in some sense how important it is that we become autonomous interpreters, how important it is that we in some way manage to strive for interpretation. Because facts alone do not work. So when we are told that there are alternative facts out there, we have to make sure that we listen carefully to who is telling this to us and who else can help us understand this further. This is why I think that one of the problems of social media has been of becoming in some way some sort of communication outlet. I think whistleblowers, of course, are vital. They are also a consequence of this return to order that I mentioned before. And they show how strong this return to order is because very little change will occur after truth is even revealed to us.
Yeah, so that brings us to the end of the book. So to wrap things up as a final sign-off, your book has hermeneutics as its conceptual backbone, and it's very much a part of your academic life, but you clearly see it as having effects and implications that go well beyond the confines of the academy. Instead, you see it as a part of our everyday lives, as well as our politics. In closing, how do you see the relationship between hermeneutics and politics today, and how would you encourage people to engage more hermeneutically in their everyday political lives?
Right, how to engage more hermeneutically in the political life. That's vital, right? It's vital that we manage in some way to, of course, being more hermeneutically active does not necessarily only mean having your own interpretation. It means understanding how important it is to help facts, like I said before, but also to understand that hermeneutic is much more than a simple academic discipline, like you said. It really involves us it involves us existentially in some way. This is why I think that, you know, given how framed we are today, or to the level of framing that politics, but also the academia, of course, but in general, the level of civilians we have reached today, what really makes us human beings today, or distinguishes us among each other also from as human beings, is really interpretation. It is really that anarchic effort we make to show that difference that is always missing there. This is why I think it is very important to point out that in some way how can we be, this is, I want to sort of finish off by pointing out that how can we see the absence of emergency, the greatest emergency, which is the absent one? What do we need there in order to see it, right? And I think that it's very important here to think of this formula that we shouldn't be really rescued from emergencies, but rather we should be rescued into emergencies. In other words, being closer to emergencies, it's basically what is going to save us. But in order to get close to this danger, because of course, thinking about an absent emergency like refugee crisis or the environment, or even the environment, it comes with it some danger. Activists have, this is not a specific peaceful engagement. It takes some courage to go to talk about certain emergencies. And I think that hermeneutics, given its anarchic vein of trying in some way also always to confront technology, but also in general whatever framing powers try to limit our freedom, I think it is the way to it is what can help us in some way to become autonomous interpreters. In other words, interpreters who are not satisfied with the world order or reality or whatever the framing is in for each one of us, and has to stand up to that. I think, and one of the ways to do this is through hermeneutic, because interpretation gives you that the possibility of emancipation from an objectivity, from a functionality, from a framing that probably has not been chosen by you. In other words, what the fact that most of our communication passes through only Google, which is a private company, should make us think how autonomous we actually are. Well, hermeneutic can help us maintain that very critical stance, very anarchic stance, which is really only there to keep the idea of being open, to keep the possibility of being emerging when it is necessary. And it is necessary every time it is absent. So hermeneutic philosophy, it's a way to maintain open the possibility of freedom, which includes difference and includes also, of course, our own existence.
Yeah, that's a wonderful kind of way to close. So as a final question, what are you working on now?
Right now, I'm preparing a new book on the problem of disruption. Disruption, as everybody knows, it's a concept mostly used in business in business management by Christensen, this professor of Harvard that recently passed away. And I am trying to reconstruct the history of disruption through this French philosopher Bernard Stiegler, and also through Heidegger. And it has really a lot to do with the idea of being rescued into the emergency, because I think that, well, the fact that we receive so many, I think that in some way, I think the absence of emergency can be also called disruption, which it's something that it's not only a rupture, but it's also we have to find, in some way, I'm thinking of hermeneutics as a possibility. You mentioned conversation before, so hermeneutics is a way of continuing the conversation against a number of disruptions, technological, but not only, that unfortunately we have to confront now.
That sounds like an absolutely fascinating book. I really look forward to that now. So, Santiago Zabala, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate this conversation.